Hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Glad to have you with us today. Today we're going to do some of our best of shows. That is, shows that have been most requested by the listeners, and I'm happy to bring them again along your way. One of the interviews, in fact, it's the most requested interview that I have. It's for my interview with Orson Scott Card. Apparently science fiction is very popular, still is. Mr. Card is the author of the Ender series. He's been involved in many screenplays along the way. And at the time we interviewed him, he had a new book coming out and had just written a screenplay that was being tossed about in Hollywood and was just about firmed up to be turned into a movie. Fact, after that, it was turned into a movie, and many of the things that you'll hear him say during the course of the interview, his concerns about the way that Hollywood would produce the movie and things of that nature, really did turn out to be true. So let's journey back a few years and listen to my interview with Orson Scott Card. With us this morning is Orson Scott Card. Orson is the New York Times best-selling author and the author of the acclaimed Ender Cycle series, a series of books that has successfully crossed gender lines by creating a sense of wonder that pulls in readers of all ages and from all walks of life. Welcome to Kansas City, Orson, and welcome to KKFI. Tell me your feelings about the way you've been boxed in as a science fiction writer. Surely you think of yourself as more than that.
I've certainly written science fiction, and I'm proud of it and perfectly happy to have my science fiction novels labeled as science fiction. Fortunately, they don't label my non-science fiction novels as science fiction, so I'm okay. I also have a couple of books in a series that I'm calling Women of Genesis, which are about, the first one is Sarah, the second one is Rebecca, about the wives of Abraham and Isaac, respectively. And another one, it will be coming soon in that series, about Rachel and Leah. And so, you know, obviously those have nothing to do with science fiction, not a spaceship among them, no time travel. But I take the book of Genesis quite seriously as a historical document and give it the full historical novel treatment for these really remarkable and interesting women. And I've written contemporary novels that have nothing to do with science fiction or the Bible. And so I'm perfectly content that each type of book finds its own readership. But the science fiction audience is one of the best groups of people you could ever write for. They're very accepting, very open. They're constantly looking for new things. That's the whole point of science fiction, is to not read the same thing you've read 1,000 times before. Now, of course, I have to exempt from that statement the readers of the Star Trek novels and the Star Wars novels, because they are, in fact, wanting to read the same thing over and over again, and they succeed in achieving that. But those of us who are writing science fiction, we try not to write the same book twice. They try not to read the same book twice. So I'm proud to be writing for that community, because they're good readers, and they're very accepting of all the weird things that I try in my fiction from time to time. At the same time, I'd like to think that I write science fiction for people who think they hate science fiction. I don't take for granted that you already know all the tropes of the field, and try to make it accessible to readers who have no idea how science fiction even works. Because science fiction does have its own way of being read. The reader not only has to follow the story and follow the characters the way that you normally would in a mainstream novel, but you also have to be developing your idea of how the world works, what the rules of science are, what the situation is, what the differences are between the reality of the novel and the reality in which the reader actually lives. And those things are brought in detail by detail, bit by bit, in the process of telling the story. And if you're not alert to them, you miss them. So you're really following two streams at once. One of them is the world creation stream, and the other one is the story stream. And it's very easy for a reader who's not used to that to lose track. Let's just say that I try to be as helpful as possible to readers who really aren't used to reading that way.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask to explain time travel to me. It seems that different authors create their own rules for what time travel is.
No, but that's the whole point, is there are no rules, because time travel is actually fantasy. It's not possible, and it is possible. We're all traveling into the future at the rate of one day per day. And so time travel one way along the track is at the same pace as everyone else is the norm, and that's what we all do. But you make up your own rules, and each subtle... When I teach writing classes, I point out that every single change changes every story that you could possibly tell within that world. So that if you you decide that you can travel into the future but not into the past. That's one kind of time travel. Or vice versa, that you can't go into the future but you can go into the past. And you make up your own little scientific mishmash stuff to explain it all. Or you make up the rule that you can't send your body into the past, but you can send your consciousness into somebody else who's living in the past. Or that you can take pictures of the past but you can't go. Or that you can listen to the past but you can't see. Or, you know, whatever rules you want. Then you can tell a story that uses those rules as a framework. The funny thing is that even though we tell stories set in universes that are different from the present reality, we're still talking about the present reality. We just use those changes in order to focus more clearly the issues that we're dealing with. So that when Ursula Le Guin, for example, in Left Hand of Darkness, wanted to talk about what is actually real and what is not real about gender roles in society, she said it on a planet where the human race had evolved in a direction that made it so that we had a monthly cycle, like estrus in many animals, where you didn't know whether at the end of the cycle you would be male or female. Well, then it's not in anybody's interest to make it so that one sex predominates over the other, because you don't know which side of the fence you're going to be on at any given time of your life. And so everybody has the experience of being male. Everybody has the experience of being female from time to time. And yet when you are within that gender, you're definitely of that gender. And so, very interesting idea that allowed her to speak clearly about issues in our society that were really important to her in the 70s when she wrote that. That's what we do in science fiction and fantasy. Even the writers who don't think they're doing that at all, I'm just writing for escape, that's nonsense. They're writing stories that they care about and believe in, and whether they mean to or not, those stories are going to deal with the issues that they care most about. So we who write science fiction and fantasy are still writing contemporary novels. We're just focusing them differently.
It is said that history repeats itself, and I guess you
It absolutely does. And there's nothing so idiotic that happened in the past that is too dumb to happen again. You know, that people just don't learn from history, especially in America, where it's taught so badly that people have no idea what it even is. And so people are able to tell the most outrageous lies about what went on in the past, and no one catches them in it because nobody studies it. You know, there are a few historians who go, wait, that isn't what happened, wait. And no one listens, no one cares, because we make the past into whatever we need it to be in order to prove our point in the present.
Now tell me a little bit about the beginnings, the genesis, as it were, of the Ender series. It started out as a short story that you then developed into a full novel?
Yeah, it was the first serious attempt I made is to write science fiction, and it attracted quite a bit of attention. It worked better than I expected it to. You know, you always hope that you'll write a story that people will really care about, but when you're starting out, you feel like you'll be lucky if they'll print it your mother and five other people read it. But it came in second for the Hugo Award when it came out, and that was really very encouraging. But at the same time, I'd already written it, and then I moved on. But then I was going to write another novel called Speaker for the Dead, and the novel really opened up for me when I realized, you know, Ender Wiggin, the character from that first story, should be the main character of this book. But I couldn't get from the end of Ender's Game to the beginning of Speaker for the Dead without going back to the short story and rewriting it as a novel. And that's the only reason that ever came into existence. I was kind of doing it just to set up the other book. Then it turned out to be my most popular book ever. So, maybe it's because I had to relax before I could write it the way it needed to be written. But the truth is, I think that Ender's Game has a particular appeal because it's about human beings who are in isolation, being pressed by other people to do tasks that they really don't want to do. But they go ahead and do their duty and manage to find some nobility and even some freedom in the process of serving the needs of their community. That sounds very abstract, and you'll never hear it in those words in the book. The book is an adventure story, the way that it's presented. But I think that especially with kids who are going to school, a place that most of them don't want to be, and under a lot of pressure to learn to behave in certain ways by society, and a set of pressures to behave in a different kind of way by their peers, that the story of Ender's Game becomes kind of a story about how to find your own way in the midst of unfreedom, to be able to make yourself free. Maybe, but I'm analyzing after the fact. I certainly had no such idea in my mind when I was writing it. When I'm writing a story, all I do is write down the story that I care about and believe in at the time. And if I start finding myself getting bored with my own story, then I realize I've stopped caring. Therefore, something's wrong with the story. Go back and revise it until I do care. And then when I'm all done, I put it out and see if somebody else cares too. And some of my books, the answer is not many people. And some of them, the answer is lots and lots of people. And I'm just glad that I have some that, that people like, and even the ones that have a smaller audience. I think of my novel, Heart's Hope. It's a very dark and depressing book with a slow beginning. And it puts a lot of readers off. But you know what? I think it's some of my very best writing. And so I'm proud that it's out there. And for those who like it, they really like it. And they're glad that it exists too. That's really... You know, when we talk about writers who are successful or not successful, I mean, the word successful was used in your intro, and I kind of cringe when I hear that because, you know, I'm successful at some things, but I look back at my older fiction. There are flaws in these books, and you know, I've learned how to write better since I wrote them. Artistically, did I succeed perfectly? Never. I don't think I ever will. I don't know of a writer who ever did. But in terms of financial success, that has nothing to do with whether you're a good writer or not. That has to do with whether you coincidentally happen to have cared about and believed in the same stories that large numbers of people will really care about and believe in. John Grisham is successful not because he's the most brilliant writer who ever lived, but because he tells stories that resonate with a very large number of people. So he makes a lot of money. Same thing with Stephen King. King is a wonderful writer. He would be a wonderful writer even if only, you know, a few hundred people read his work. There'd be less of it because he'd have to have a day job. But it's wonderful when a writer can find a large audience. But it has nothing to do with whether his work is truthful or powerful or successful. That's I think there's a different standard of measurement.
Having said that, now it's moving into a whole new medium now. Motion pictures
right.
being made from your work. You're working on your first screenplay.
Oh,
what
no,
are the adjustments?
I've written about a dozen screenplays. You know, you don't just start from scratch and think you can do it. I was a playwright before I wrote fiction too, so that I've written about 250 audio plays. So, you know, I've done a lot of different stuff and moved from medium to medium. But with screenplays, it's especially hard because you have to please two audiences. You have to write a screenplay that can be read by executives who will then realize that they need to put their money into it. And then the same screenplay is supposed to work as the blueprint for a movie that will be seen, a very different experience, by audiences, and that they'll love it and tell their friends, and they'll all come back and see it 15 times, and it'll make $1 billion. Always the goal of the studio, by the way, even when they pretend that it's just a little small picture and they don't expect it to make much. They really are hoping it'll be the big breakout that you know, earns worldwide millions and millions of dollars. But... the two purposes of writing a script are absolutely contradictory because it's very hard to read a script and know what you're reading. Very, very hard. And I don't know of many executives who can do it. So you have to write a selling script. And then when it's time to, once you sold it, then you have to go back and change it into a shooting script, which is a very different kind of thing. And a lot of the stuff that you have to include in the selling script, just so that it'll be clear to the readers, you have to remove from the shooting script. Well, so far I've been writing selling scripts for the obvious reason that they weren't yet sold. This is my first experience writing a script that is actually meant to be the script you shoot. We have executives at Warner who are sharp. They get the story. They understand what it needs to be. I don't have to write a selling script now. They understand how the story needs to go. See, I've had a lot of people whose first reaction to Ender's Game was, well, we can make it into a movie, but we have to change the hero from a 9-year-old into a 16-year-old because we've got to get that teen audience. And I just cringe because the whole point of this is that these are innocent children. And there is no such thing as an innocent 16-year-old. He'd have to be really dim-witted to be non-skeptical of what adults tell him. But, you know, a 9-year-old who has lived in a completely sheltered environment where he hasn't had a chance to have experiences outside of what adults have shaped for him is going to be naive enough to believe things that an older kid never would believe. There's no story if Ender is 16 years old. But so many people have not seen it, and I've just, you know, come out of meetings just despairing that it would ever get made. But I think this time we might be able to do it. Wolfgang Peterson is a wonderful director. Working with him and his partner, Sam Dickerman, they are wonderful, sharp, storytellers. They understand how stories work. And so everything they say adds to my understanding of how the movie needs to go, and they understand everything I'm talking about. It's a great, great experience. There are a lot of good, smart people in Hollywood. You wouldn't know that from some of the films that come out, but there really are. And every now and then, that's why every now and then a really terrific film squeaks through.
Yeah, you talked about in the notes. It talks about the dehumanization of war and the way the children are conditioned through the use of playing a game.
Well, you talk about dehumanization. It's hard to think of an activity more human than war. you don't become dehumanized. You simply dehumanize your enemy so that you can do whatever you want to him. In your mind, you have to, and you have to. You can't go out and start killing somebody if you're sitting there thinking, you know, he has a wife I wonder how his sister will feel when he never comes home or when I maim him. That's a terrible thing. You can't possibly conduct war if you're thinking that way about your enemy. You have to be thinking, that's a monster who's going to kill me. If I don't kill him, he's going to kill me. And if he gets past me, he's going to kill everything I love. Sometimes that's even true. You know, Adolf Hitler and what he planned to do, monstrous thing. But there were appeasers before World War II who honestly said, why do we need an army? If an enemy came to our shores, I would simply walk out, greet the enemy, and say, what is it that you want? Let's sit down together and let's see how we can get it for you. And I just think, well, that's swell, but what if the enemy says, well, I want to kill all of your Jews, and if you happen to have any gypsies, we'll kill them too, and then all of your children, we'll use them as slaves and take them off to Germany to work our factories. Hope you don't mind. At that point, you think, oh, maybe we do need to fight. But by then, you know, if you're an appeaser, you don't have an army. You have no way of stopping them. You've already lost. There are times when you have to fight. And so when I write a book like Ender's Game, which is about war, or Shadow Puppets, which has war as one of the central elements involved in it, I really don't write that much military fiction, but in this particular series, military themes are important because that's who the characters are, that's what they do. And it's not that I'm anti-war or pro-war. I regard war as something that humans are going to do because we always have, and I haven't yet seen a new species evolving that doesn't have those same needs, drives, and instincts. It's that you have to, you know, it matters a great deal in fighting a war whether your soldiers really believe they're in the right. And I think that one of the reasons that Hitler lost World War II was because most German soldiers knew that, in fact, it would be a disaster for the world if they won. They did their duty. They were loyal to the fatherland. But it was outrageous to them what was being done in their name. And you just can't fight as well when you don't believe in your own cause. Our trouble as a people is holding together a belief in our cause. You know, America is a great nation and stands for great things. We're a flawed nation. We've made plenty of mistakes. But I hear a lot of rhetoric today that would take our mistakes and act as if they trump what we do that's good. And the truth is, there's a reason why our democratic example has been followed by nation after nation. It's because the people who live in a fairly democratic society, one that still maintains good order but is otherwise democratic and reasonably fair, are happier than people who live in dictatorships or one religion states or one party states where there are no options, and if you offend people, offend the wrong people, you're dead. Or you can't work again, whatever. It's better. And we're not imposing our will on other people when we go to war against somebody who would destroy what we stand for. We're instead genuinely bringing a benefit to other people. It's not that we should go out and conquer the world so they can be as wonderful and happy and free as we are. But we do have a responsibility to our own people to protect our people. And we do have a responsibility to help those who are trying to live in the way that we have already demonstrated is happier and better than some of the other ways that you can be governed. There, that's my sermon, you know. But
it was good.
I'm not pro-war. War's terrible.
No one
wants to go through it. But when it's forced upon you, you do want to make sure that you win.
In a work of fiction in general, not just science fiction, you can create your own reality.
Well, that's right. And I set up the rules so that I can decide who the good guys are.
And make it turn out the way you want it to.
That's right.
Do you have any plans beyond this cycle of series?
Oh, I'm writing many different things all along. I have dozens of standalone books that are not part of any series. I have four or five different series going at any given time. They are every kind of science fiction that there is, because believe me, there's more variety inside science fiction than there is outside it. And I have my poems, my plays, my screenplays. You know, I'm busy. The main thing is that it's all writing, because I haven't yet figured out anything else I can do that people will pay me for.
Well, that's interesting. You see yourself as a variety, really, more than anything else.
You know what I enjoy best, though? Teaching.
What? teaching?
Yeah, but you just can't make any money at it. I have employees I'd have to fire if I ever quit and went into teaching full time.
Can you teach someone to write, or is that something that just has to be
there? There are techniques in writing that you can absolutely teach. You can't give people the fire, and you can't give them the stories to tell and the passion to tell them. But you can give them the skills to be able to tell them more effectively, and that's what I do.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Orson Scott Card, the author of the new book Shadow Puppets and the Ender series in general. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
It's my pleasure.
Orson Scott Card with a little Mation Williams thrown in there on the Arts Magazine program. Yes, that movie did get made. Some of the fears he had as to what they would do casting-wise, the age of the young man and all that, did come into play, unfortunately. So how anxious he is to go diving back into the movie scripts, I don't know. But I think it was a pretty decent movie all along. Thank you. I thank him for coming by. Orson Scott Card, a famous science fiction writer here on the Arts Magazine show. So we're going to take a break now. When we return, much more for you. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. We're going to continue with our Christmas holiday theme shows now. And we're going to feature, as we have in previous years, some previous years anyway, I guess they skipped this past year, Jennifer will explain, the Owen Cox Dance Company is with us, and they are doing their annual holiday presentation of The Nutcracker and The Mouse King. And Jennifer Owen was with us. She is the artistic director and co-founder of the Owen Cox Dance Company. And, of course, they're doing their version of The Nutcracker, a little different than the ballet's version of The Nutcracker. And we will talk about the ins and outs of that. But welcome to the show once again, Jennifer.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
How's the family? How's Mom? How's everything going?
Everyone's doing well.
That's great. And you're in big preparation for this show, as usual.
We are.
You are well known for doing collaborations on your productions, and I'll bet this year is no different.
Yes. Well, this production includes the People's Liberation Big Band of Greater Kansas City, which is an incredible 16-piece ensemble that my husband directs, Brad Cox. And the production actually premiered in 2009. And it's a very different interpretation of the, you know, traditional Nutcracker. It's based on the E.T.A. Hoffman story, which was written in 1816. And it's a lot darker and weirder and thornier than the production that we mostly are familiar with today.
So it sounds like a lot more fun. Not to put down the ballet version. It's very beautiful to watch the ballet's version. But yours is good, too. It's just a little darker story, more like the original story.
It's based on the original story. It includes the story within the story of the hard nut, which explains how the Nutcracker came to be. And we include narration so that people can follow the story. It's funny. It's beautiful. It's raucous. It kind of has a lot of different components that make it very fun and entertaining and moving.
I'll bet so. What do you do to put your own particular mark on a show like this? I mean, artistic directors like to do that. They, you know, you're basically following a certain pattern, as it were. But you like to put your own mark on things, I've noticed.
Yes, well, I choreographed the production, and Brad and I worked closely together from the early stages back in 2009 when we created it. And the choreography is very inspired by the music. The music is very innovative and fun and includes all of the Tchaikovsky melodies, but they're, you know, rearranged for the big band. And I think what's fun about the production is people will often recognize the music that they've heard, that they know and love, that Tchaikovsky wrote, but it's completely different. And I think that's what keeps it fresh and interesting and relevant, reflects our times.
Yeah, well, along with the band, of course, you have dancers, which I suppose you get to handpick for this particular production.
Yes, we have nine incredible professional dancers doing the production. We have Darwin Black as the Nutcracker and Laura Hunt as Marie, and then a wonderful ensemble of dancers. Christopher Barksdale will be joining us once again to be Drosselmeyer, and we also have six students from Paseo Academy of the Fine and Performing Arts working with us. Actually, nine. It's a cast of six, but three of the dancers alternate, so we have a total total of 9. And this year we have a dancer from Paseo Academy working with us who is completely deaf. So this is the first time that I've had that opportunity to work with a dancer who is deaf, and it's a wonderful chance for us to get to work with her in our production.
Does the dancer follow, since she can't hear the music, does she follow the movements that she sees the other dancers do?
She does, and she has a very inherent sense of rhythm. There is a sign translator or interpreter present at all rehearsals, so she's always understanding everything that's being said, and she's a very musical dancer and very quick to pick things up.
The performance will be on, there'll be two, Saturday, December the 10th at 8 o'clock p.m. and Sunday, December the 11th at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Polsky Theater on the campus of Johnson County Community College. The address, easiest address in town to remember, 12345 College Boulevard, Overland Park. The number to call for more information, perhaps to make arrangements, to ask questions, is 913-469-4445, or online. I guess they can make their arrangements on your website as well. Mm-hmm. That is owencoxdance.org. So we've talked about some of the dancers, the musicians. Any other little twist you're going to have in there?
Every year we like to kind of freshen things up a bit. So we stay true to the production, at large, but we always like to kind of add different things that happen to keep it fun and new every year.
Now, you didn't do it last year. I mean, you announced that you were going to another town. You did it, but it was in another town.
Well, we took a year off, actually. It's a very big production to put on, and so it felt like... and we also have plans to tour it, but it, last year was a good year to take a year off and bring it back this year. So people have been asking us, when are you doing that production again? So now's their chance to see it.
Well, people who have seen both versions, yours probably is closer to the original story, I would say. But they say they enjoy yours just as much as they enjoy the other, if not more so.
It's fun to compare and contrast. They're two different, productions completely. So I think it's fun, actually, if you can see both.
Well, the last time I attended, the artistic director of the ballet was in the audience.
Yeah, so we're thrilled to be presenting it once again this year. And it's a very colorful production, and it's a very diverse cast. The costumes were designed by Peggy Nolan, and Peregrine Honig. Mark Sutherland is our Mouse King. And then the cast, a lot of the dancers have ballet backgrounds, but a lot of them have more modern and contemporary backgrounds. So it has a very different feel and look to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, because of the story, the costuming is very important to make it a little more, feel like you're in that time period as well. And I find that some people say they don't know the storyline of the Nutcracker. But it's very easy to follow if you're watching, but perhaps you'd like to tell them a little bit about what the story is like.
It's a story about love and growing up, and the fears that we have about growing up and becoming an adult.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
People often ask, is this real or is it a dream? And I say, well, that's something you have to decide for yourself.
Well, the story has a lot of twists and turns, and we don't really have the dream factor in this production. It's all basically Marie's experience, and she brings the Nutcracker to life through her love. It's a little bit of a Beauty and the Beast story, if that makes sense. So
think of the times and think of the location, and it was Tchaikovsky, of course. So there was some Russian influence there.
Right, the Tchaikovsky music is so incredible. And one thing that's interesting, the ballet is very beautiful and sweet, and I think a lot of that is because the Tchaikovsky music is so melodious and beautiful and sweet that even though there's a dark side of the story, if we were to try to do our production to the Tchaikovsky music, the orchestrated version, it would be hard to get that element of dark and thorny. But because the big band performs in these different arrangements, those arrangements reflect the feel of the story. We can go different places that we wouldn't be able to otherwise with the Tchaikovsky orchestrated version.
You've done the show a bunch of times now. So I would normally ask, well, how difficult is it to do with new arrangements for the dancers to and the band to kind of coordinate together mm-hmm. on things? But that's probably not a concern because it's probably a lot of the same people that have worked with before.
Yes, and the dancers are very quick and professional and bring a lot of themselves to the production as well. So it kind of changes every year depending on the cast. Mm-hmm. We have a new Nutcracker this year I'm very excited to work with. He danced with Sacramento Ballet and wow. Pascal Rio, who is a Martha Graham dancer. So he has a very balletic background but also a modern background. And he'll be joining us from Two Dance, which is based out of Minneapolis, and just a phenomenal dancer. I'm very excited to have him perform with us.
Yeah, you have people from all over the country come in and do your shows. Is it that you're very well known? You have a good reputation? What do you think is the big factor?
It's a small world. So once you're in the dance world, you I think have connections throughout the country and sometimes internationally too, just by people that you know. It's, people who are friends of friends or recommendations by people that you know and trust. So, and there's always Facebook, too, which connects a lot of us and keeps
it
us
sure
up to
does,
date. And,
it?
Yeah, and then, dancers nowadays, if they're freelance dancers, they often have a video of their performance material that you can view, and it's a much easier audition process to some degree that you can see how the dancer works.
Are you the most comfortable, perhaps, with people you know?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Whenever possible, I work with the same people that I know that live in Kansas City. Recently, Laura Hunt joined us. She just retired from the Kansas City Ballet last year, and she's fantastic, and so I'm thrilled to be working with her. Holly DeWitt is a regular dancer with us, and Christopher Barksdale Burns I've known since I was 13 years old as a student in Seattle, so it's great to still have that professional relationship and the friendship that goes very deep. So
that's a real feather in your cap, I would think. People, they've retired from the ballet, but they'll still work with you.
Well, we hope they will.
That's happened in several cases, of course. Makes it a little easier. And of course, it doesn't hurt having Christopher Barksdale on the publicity doesn't hurt one bit, does it?
Yeah, he's one, he's still an incredible mover. And it's also wonderful. This Sunday will be the first time that we'll have the students and the company together. And it's really fun to see how the students look up to the professional dancers and how they interact and how the professional dancers will coach the students. And it's just a really nice partnership, I think. And good for everyone involved.
Sure. We're speaking with Jennifer Owen. She's the Owen of Owen Cox Dance Company. She's here to talk about their annual presentation of The Nutcracker and the Mouse King, a little darker version of the story than you see in other places, but as we talked about earlier, probably more true to the original story. Mm-hmm. And different adaptations have been done. Now, the one that the ballet does is by one adapter, and the one you do is by a different adapter, correct?
Well, yeah, generally the traditional ballet is based more on the Alexander Dumas story of the Nutcracker, and E.T.A. Hoffman wrote the Nutcracker and the Mouse King back in 1816, and that one has a lot more twists and turns, and it's kind of a strange tale.
Yeah, well, their version by design involves more children, and it's written that way. Or do you have just as many kids?
No, we have six students in our cast. Uh-huh. We're working with nine this year who alternate. So we have a smaller, I think more compact cast. That's the nature of the production. And so we have nine professional dancers and six students. So, and 16 musicians. Oh, and Mark Sutherland, who's a real fixture in our arts community. So
heading the band, of course, is your husband.
Yes. He is the band leader, yes. And he also plays the role of Drosselmeyer from the musician's standpoint. So there's a Drosselmeyer dancer and a Drosselmeyer musician band leader, mm-hmm. who's kind of pulling all the strings and making everything happen. Just as Drosselmeyer in the story is making everything happen, Brad as Drosselmeyer is kind of the band leader, making all of that.
Oh, very talented
together.
Family. And he, of course, brought along some great musicians as well
to
play with him.
Yes, we have a wonderful group of musicians. We have Roger Wilder, Rich Wheeler, Jeff Harshberger, Sam Weissman, KKFI's own Sam Weissman. Yes.
Along with Roger and Jeff.
That's right, yes. It's all the family.
They're all mainstays around here.
That's right. So it's a really remarkable ensemble.
And they look forward to working with you. I hear them talking.
Aww.
I'm working that gig.
Oh, I'm so glad.
That, when are you having her on? She'll be on soon.
Well, thank you.
But they're anxious to work with you, so they must really enjoy working with your group.
Well, thank you. It goes both ways. We're very lucky to work with them. So.
Yeah. How many years has Owen Cox been going here?
This is our 10th season. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a big birthday for us. Happy birthday, us.
Happy birthday, Owen Cox.
Which, for a nonprofit organization to, you know, keep going and grow, it's a labor of love.
Well, I'll bet so. Of course, you know, putting on shows is probably the hardest thing, but probably a close second is raising money.
Well, putting on the shows is what we love to do. The fundraising and the marketing and all the administrative side is part of it that we have to do to produce the work that we love. So it's all part of it.
Do you have sponsorships? Do you seek that out?
We do all the time. So if anybody wants to sponsor this show or any of our shows, feel free to contact us.
If they go to your website, the number I have here is probably the number at the College for Tickets. Is there a number for you to call?
There is, 816-533-5904. That is our office number.
You can ask any questions you have about that or future productions. You usually have a full season, even after the holidays.
Yes, we just had our fall performance, and that was a collaboration with Kansas City Chamber Orchestra. That was in October, and it had some wonderful music that we performed dance with, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, Shostakovich's 8-string quartet, as well as Vivaldi Double Cello Concerto and Benjamin Britten's Simple Symphony. That was a really fun concert to do. In May, we have a spring performance at the Folly Theater that's called Inland Roads, and it's featuring a company that we worked with out of Rhode Island, the Island Moving Company. They hosted us over the summer for a 2.5-week residency, and we performed in Newport, Rhode Island, and now they're coming to perform with us in May 6th at the Folly Theater. So we're excited about that. And in June 10th and 11th, we'll be bringing back the Goldberg Variations, which we premiered in 2013, and was very, very well received, and it's just a beautiful work of music that Kairi Kostroyeva will be performing live with us, and we do the entire Goldberg Variations with repeats, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful work. We're excited to present it again.
Sure, and of course, all these things have to be planned probably much more than a year ahead of time.
Yes, they do. So we've been working on it for quite a while, and we're excited to be getting to the point where we actually present them.
Do you get asked to go out of town to do someone else's show in another place?
Well, we've had some touring that we've done. So for the summer residency we had in Rhode Island, that was a really fun partnership. We had 10 performances in a Quaker meeting house called the Great Friends Meeting House. It's the oldest Quaker meeting house in North America. It was built in 1699. And while we were there at the residency, I choreographed a piece on both Owen Cox Dance Group dancers and Island Moving Company dancers. So I had 14 dancers to work with on this piece, which was a much larger number than I normally have. And that was a really wonderful experience. And we'll be presenting that piece for Kansas City audiences at the Folly Show in May when they come to perform with us. And that actually was a piece that Brad Cox wrote as well, called Three Fables, that the People's Liberation Big Band recorded. So it's all still in the family.
I really should ask him sometime when he comes. But how do you compose a piece? Does he sit down at the keyboard and just try things out? And do you listen and say, no, yes, yes?
No, I never chime in, no. And usually it's I... I can't speak for him as far as his process, but it starts, you know, various ways. Sometimes it's at the piano, sometimes it's on the computer. There's always something going on in his brain that I don't know until he shares it with me. So it's really fun. He loves having time to work on music. That's like his, if he could do anything, it would just be creating music. So now that we have a two-year-old, our time is much more limited. And so he's like, can I have 2 hours to work on music today? I'm like, yes.
Still yet another Owen Cox production.
It's the same for me. I need time to dance and move. And so, you know, we try to make sure that we find time to do what we love. So
if too much time goes by and you haven't danced in a while, do you get the urge just to dance around the house?
Maybe? Oh, yeah. I can't sit still. so I need to channel that energy physically somehow. So, yeah.
What would you like to see the group go? I mean, I'm sure you have an idea, and then you have a dream of where you'd like to see it all evolve into.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I feel like we've developed a really strong following. I would like to see our audience grow. I still feel like there are a lot of Kansas Cityans that have not seen our work yet, and we would love to perform for more people. We have an educational program called Take the Stage, which is a year-round in-school residency. We're in 7 schools right now. We'd like to see that program grow and serve more children. We would also like to tour regionally and nationally and possibly internationally, because I feel like the work that we've produced is of very high quality, and we want to represent Kansas City in other communities and also get more mileage of all the work that we've invested into creating these productions. So that's what we'd like to see. We'd like to, you know, grow and do more performances for more people and have that support.
Oh, sure. Well, you studied and worked out of the country, so you must want to go back there sometime with your own group. That would probably be a big kick for you.
I would love to. In fact, Kairi Kishoyeva, the pianist who's performing the Goldberg Variations with us, she's from Kyrgyzstan, and at one point, we were trying to find a way to bring the production, either have our dancers perform in Kyrgyzstan or for us to travel and set the work on the ballet company in Kyrgyzstan. And I think should keep pursuing that, because there was some interest, and we just haven't had the time or resources to really kind of keep that that conversation open, but I think we'd like to do that. Because she has connections in the former Soviet Union, and I danced in Russia for 4 years, so I think there's an opportunity there.
And I just have a feeling in the years to come there'll be a lot more exchange-type programs like that going on.
Yeah. For example, our trip to Rhode Island this summer was a really great chance to work with other companies. There were several companies that came to Newport to perform, and so it was a great chance for the artistic directors to meet and share ideas about best practices, and for the dancers to be together and share ideas. And it was a really... I hate to sound cheesy, but kind of a bonding experience, you know, and making us feel like we're not alone, that there's a large dance community out there, and we're in this together, and we want to be, you know, producing beautiful work.
Saturday, December the 10th at 8 o'clock p.m. Performances continue the next day on the 11th, a matinee at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Polsky Theater on the campus of Johnson County Community College. The address is 12345 College Boulevard. The number to call for more information, 913-469-4445, or arrangements can be made online at owencoxdance.org. Jennifer Owen, Brad Cox, Owen Cox Dance Company. Thanks so much for being with us, Jennifer.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
As always, you're very talented indeed. Boy, the Jazz Insider's next, Sam Weissman. In fact, Jennifer mentioned his name earlier. He'll be on next. He'll be playing jazz from 1 to 3, and then the blues from 3 to 5 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. Until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that crossing the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.